Welcome to College Tour, the podcast, together with master students, journalism and new media here at the University of Leiden. Tonight's guest is a visionary and a pioneer in the world of investigative journalism, so successful that his life has been threatened. He was the very first to discover that the flight from Amsterdam to Malaysia, MH17, was downed by Russian separatists. And among many other stories about wars in Gaza and Libya, he has special attention for President Putin in Moscow. Together with the students here in Leiden, we will interview the founder of Bellingcat. Here is Elliot Higgins.
Hello, Elliot. Please take a seat.
Thank you so much for coming out to Leiden.
Thanks for inviting me.
First of all, for those of you who don't know, we have to congratulate you because you are the recipient in February next year of an honorary doctorate here of the University of Leiden.
Yes, I'm very honoured and I'm looking forward to the ceremony.
Were you surprised?
Yeah, it's my first honorary degree, so it's always a surprise when they come along.
So have you ever sat here in a college hall? Were you a student at a university?
I was not a very successful student, so over 25 years later, I'm finally getting my degree.
What went wrong?
Everything basically went wrong, so... I have to admit, I was not the most focused academic when I was younger, so that came later.
Did you hate it to sit in a hall like this and to listen to prophecy?
I didn't hate it, no. I just, was not a very good student.
Opening question here, as always, what kind of student was Elliot Higgins on the scale of sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Do I have to rate each of them?
Yes.
Probably. I'd like to say I was at least a 6 or a 7, but I was probably closer to a 2 or a 3. So,
for all of them, or
probably close to 0 for some. But
which one of the?
It's 3? An average. Well, let's not go there.
Oh, okay. let's start with the moment that you decided to work in an office, and apparently you were so bored that you started to do other things. What kind of job did you get after university, after your studies?
So I worked in various kind of admin roles. I worked for like Barclays Bank in London, processing orders and doing financial administration jobs and stuff like that. So it was nothing to do with the kind of work that I do now at all.
So where did the interest come from to start digging and researching?
I was always somebody who spent a lot of time on the internet, even from, being very young. This is probably before all of your time, but in the 90s, we had things like CompuServe and the old dial-up modem, so that's kind of where I started off. And I always was following kind of politics quite closely, especially in the US. My childhood was basically bookended by the first Gulf War at the start of the 90s and then 9/11 in 2001. So I think that kind of developed and into a certain worldview. And when the Arab Spring came around, it was the first time that kind of these online spaces were as much as part of these conflicts as the real world space was. There was a huge amount of information being shared there. And I just found it really fascinating to use that as a resource to learn more about the things that I was interested in. And I was shocked that no one else was doing that.
And at the bank where you were working at the time, was it possible to steal some time of the bank and start looking into these stories?
It was actually later on when I was working for a company called Refugee Support, where I was helping do all the admin for housing asylum seekers at the time. And so what happened there is I got the job and I was very efficient with computers and I reduced my working week down to about a day and a half of work. So I had lots of time to read stuff on the internet whilst I was waiting for work to turn up. And a lot of that was about Syria and Libya and all the things that were happening there.
You're writing about it, right? Some kind of blog? Could you say that it started
like
that?
I started blogging in 2012. So really for me, it was never like I started a blog and I'm going to be a professional journalist. And it was more like, this is interesting. I want someone to write it down that's longer than Twitter and more permanent than an internet post on a forum. So I started writing it down. I was using the name the Brown Moses blog. And Brown Moses was a nickname I'd used since the late 90s. It was just a Frank Zappa song I was listening to when I registered to an internet forum, but it kind of just became the name I used the most online. So there was this kind of, I was quite a mysterious figure in the first couple of years of doing this because of that.
When did people started to find out what you were doing and you developed an interest with journalists for your stories?
It was really part of being that kind of late 2000s, early 2010s kind of social media community that formed on Twitter. Because Twitter used to be a really good space for journalists and people who worked on with NGOs and activists, as well as people who are on the ground in those Arab Spring countries sharing information. So it became a really good space for people to come together and discuss stuff. And I, at the time, was just kind of obsessively looking at these videos and photos coming from Libya. There was a journalist called CJ Chivers who worked for the New York Times who specialized in things like surface-to-air missile launchers and the use of them in terrorism. So he started following my work and giving that a boost. And just over time, I built an audience of journalists and arms experts and people interested in, you know, very particular things, and just built that audience myself and really just kept at it until it kind of just started breaking through beyond that.
Is there a specific story that was so interesting to others that suddenly you got this mass following, that people were looking you up?
The first really big story I had was in early 2013. I had spent about a year plus looking at videos coming from Syria, and that was like every single day I would go onto a list of YouTube channels I followed, which were used by Syrian opposition groups as the only real source of information. And no one else had bothered to do that. So I had this just unique stream of information coming from, you know, this place which was in the news at the time that no one else had bothered to look at.
So when did you change the name of Brown Moses into Bellingcat?
So after about 2 years of blogging, I realized that there's a growing audience, both in terms of people who were trying to do open source investigation themselves, and they were coming to me and asking, could they publish on my blog? But then I was getting the credit for their work because it was under my online pseudonym. And also I wanted a place where people could come and learn how to do open source investigation. So I thought I need to start a new website. My old website was on Blogspot and looked really terrible as well. So I thought I needed a more professional looking site. So I crowdfunded a fairly cheap but reliable looking website. Started on July 14th, 2014, and then 3 days later, MH17 was shot down, and that acted as a massive catalyst, not only for Bellingcat and my work, but the whole field of open source investigation in general.
Yes, and the name Bellingcat is naturally from the cat, to put the bell on a cat, right?
So it's based off a fable about a group of mice who are very frightened of a large cat. And they have a meeting and decide they need to put a bell onto the cat's neck. But then a very clever wise mouse tells them that who's actually brave enough to do that. So what we're trying to do is teach people how to bell the cat.
Right. I had time also to speak to somebody that you know very well. He's from Friesland, Leeuwarden, Christian Triebert. He worked for you and he now works at the New York Times, where he's doing the same work as what you do, for a bigger medium, and he has this message for you.
Elliot Higgins, the fascinating case of Elliot Higgins is that he changed journalism even though he never worked for a journalism outlet. Elliot is a huge inspiration for me. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Elliot.
At the New York Times.
Here at the New York Times, yeah. I mean, I was always interested in journalism, but I never studied journalism, but I was interested in it. I applied for a journalism job at a Dutch newspaper while I was already doing this like open source stuff. Inspired by Elliot, I was looking at satellite imagery, I was looking at videos, trying to locate them. Then I was like, oh, let me try to apply this to journalism. Applied to a Dutch newspaper, they're like, nah, this is not journalism, you should maybe work for like something like a think tank. Elliot, on the other hand, was like, great. Welcome. This is great stuff you're doing. Write a blog post about it. Write another one. Find out more. Elliot kind of embodies that you, all of you, can investigate whatever you want if you have the curiosity and if you have the willingness to challenge yourself. How can I find out more information about it? And I think what is so striking about Eliot? He didn't have the resources of the New York Times. He didn't have the big name of like a top journalist in the world. He just started because he wanted to figure out things. And he did that in collaboration with others. Whatever you want to do, it doesn't matter. But you may feel like, okay, big media already published on this. I don't have the resources. But Eliot shows that you don't need to have that to get started and actually to make an impact too. And I think when you take that into mind, when you are approaching the topic you're working on, think of that. Like Eliot just started from behind his laptop. I just started from behind my laptop without any resources, not getting paid, but the curiosity and the willingness to investigate. So I hope Eliot can inspire you all as much as he did me.
Christian Tribot, is he right?
Yeah, he is right. I really encourage people to get involved with this stuff. Everything really Bellingcat is doing, like I said in 2014, I launched it because I wanted a space for people to learn how to do this. And that's not just for kind of my own ego. It's because I believe that we have access to a vast amount of information, but we don't necessarily use that information in a very good way. And that maybe the way the internet is set up with algorithms and communities, it encourages sometimes some of the worst aspects of our psychology. But I've seen at Bellingcat people do amazing things from all kinds of different backgrounds. They didn't need to have a qualification in journalism if you're doing journalism studies, good for you and get that qualification.
One could say that you are also saying you guys could start now. It's nice to study, but you could start now working on all this.
Yeah, don't wait for people to give you permission to start writing stuff. I mean, I'm not going to say it's going to be your best work, but it's how I started was basically every single day I wrote a post on my blog. And some of those posts weren't very good, but it was practice. It was me actually figuring out the process of doing the investigations by writing it down, by thinking how I would present that to someone who was reading it in a way that they would understand.
So Christian is now working Tribot for the New York Times.
Yeah.
Did you hate him to see go from Bellingcat to the legacy media, as they call it in the US, to the New York Times?
Well, my goal with Bellingcat and just open source in general is I think open source investigation is really valuable and really important. And it came from an amateur online community of people who had no reason to be taken seriously, effectively. It's just a bunch of people on the internet figuring this stuff out. So a big part of my work was always looking at how do I get more people doing this? How do I get people to believe that this is something that works? And part of that was demonstrating it through the work that we do. But it's also like, you know, when Christian goes to the New York Times, he's taking not only that knowledge he has, but also kind of ethos that Bellingcat has about collaboration and finding people to team up with. And if you look at legacy media 5-10 years ago in terms of how they collaborated with each other, that has changed a lot because now they have open source investigations where it shows that it's valuable not only to, you know, kind of use the open source material, but it opens the doorway to collaboration with not just other journalists, but other types of organizations that before they were quite resistant to.
So you're even maybe happy that he's over there being an ambassador for the work that you started.
Yeah, I mean, when people leave Bellingcat, it's just, you know, if they keep doing open source investigation, but it's somewhere new, then that's, in my mind, a good thing. That means there'll be more open source investigation there.
Right. Let's open up the hall for questions here. If you have a question, please stand up and the microphone will come to you. Two people in the hall have the microphones. You are the first one to stand up. If somebody else wants to ask a question, please stand up now so we can come with the microphone.
Hi, I'm Laura. I was wondering how you think artificial intelligence changes the way you do open research investigation?
Yeah, sure. It affects it in a number of different ways. Some of it is less worrying. So I think there's been this fear that you'll be able to use AI images to create a completely false event that will lead to real-world impact. And I think that's not the easiest thing to do. I think you have to look at information online in terms of kind of the kind of immediate reaction people have to it and the actual analysis and understanding of that information that takes a lot longer. Now, in terms of false information, be it AI generated or, you know, a whole range of other things that we see all the time, it's that kind of initial quick moment of it spreading where it's kind of poses the most danger. I think social media companies need to really be required to put in AI imagery detection as part of their posting procedure. So if you're about to post a picture and it looks, the system thinks it's AI generated, then it says this will be flagged as AI generated at a minimum. You're seeing more examples of AI imagery being used to illustrate all kinds of things. Like, if does anyone in here use Facebook? I'm guessing not. But yeah, it, probably wrong age.
Anybody over there in the back, somebody's using it.
There we go.
Okay. So you have to explain what it is then.
Facebook is just a stream of AI-generated trash now. It's like an unusable platform because even if you follow lots of friends, their posts are downranked and you have to go through sea of just garbage posts that for some reason have 25,000 likes and comments and stuff like that.
So it's all a big lie, that's what you're saying. What you're looking at is just the fantasy world that they create for you?
Well, I wouldn't even call it that because I don't want to see that rubbish, but it's the broader, what we know, call in academic circles, the inshitification of the internet, where there's just constant AI trash being generated for people to click on. That's what worries me more than disinformation, because in terms of disinformation, I mean, you just have to look at kind of Israel and Gaza, and you've got people who are sharing not AI-generated imagery, but imagery from other conflicts, saying this is in Syria, just so they can get those likes and those retweets and those subscriptions. Because one thing social media and social media algorithms have taught us is how to, you know, if you want lots of followers, if you want lots of engagement, churn out emotionally engaging content, because people are going to look at it for about 1 second before they decide whether or not they're going to react to it. And if it's a complex Bellingcat investigation, people don't really share that stuff like that. If it's a picture of something that looks sad and makes you feel a bit upset, then you're more likely to share that, whatever the topic is. So what this has taught people is that you just churn out garbage. And you see it everywhere now. Yeah, I think now we're seeing video AI generation as well. There's some really amazing work being done with that. But I've already seen when P. Diddy was arrested with all that hand lotion in his bathroom. You can look it up if you want. Just be careful when you're Googling. There was someone who posted a, you know, breaking headline saying, you know, P. Diddy arrested, hand lotion, all that stuff. And there was a video with it of police in a bathroom with loads of, almost a comic amount of hand lotion bottles everywhere. And people were sharing it and reacting to the video. But what that person had done, they just generated an AI video to illustrate a text post. And I think this is where the next kind of, you know, the next front in the inshitification of the internet is going to come. Just loads of AI-generated video content to go along with stories that are text-based, just so people get engagement.
But how do we know, that's the question here, that something is not real, not authentic? I mean, you have to be a specialist almost to see if it's nonsense or real.
Yeah, most people don't care because they're not going on the internet for an intellectual exercise. They're doing it for a dopamine hit. But I think we need to look at how we've changed our relationship with information. We've gone down from, there's a kind of traditional top-down gatekeeped information model where, you know, newspaper editors, the government, decide what information is kind of coming down from the top of the power structure. Now we have this peer-to-peer relationship with each other online through social media. And I think that Bellingcat has demonstrated how valuable and useful that can be, but it also encourages some of the worst elements of our human behavior, effectively. Yeah. It's very, very good at doing that.
Next question. Please stand up and the microphone will come to you.
So obviously you've aided and instigated in many international investigations that have led to very real-world consequences. So like MH17, most notably here, Syria, everything in Yemen. And while that has led to actual sanctions or punishments being put in place for you finding out all of these things, or Bellingcat, I should say, I guess it just never ends because some new war crime or killing or massacre or whatever always keeps popping up. So I was just wondering if you ever feel jaded by that, by just essentially your work never really ending, which must be kind of sad, I imagine, especially in your line of work.
Well, the good thing is I was really jaded when I started doing this. So any success is seen as on top of that rather than, you know, just wanting just this relentless you know, life of just terrible things happening all the time. But the way I see it is that we as a community have a really good opportunity to respond to that in a way that we've never been able to do before. We have access to tools and information that actually offer us a huge amount of power and influence. And it's really just figuring out how you connect to that and you use that, and looking not just in terms of, okay, what do I do, but what do I do as part of a community that's connected to all kinds of different people, and how do you make the most of that?
So you said you were jaded before you got success with this. So this Bellingcat, your research, did it give you a reason to live, a raison d'être?
Well, I'm not sure a reason to live, but it's certainly... I found it really inspirational that, you know, I started doing this work and I didn't really think of myself too much in the context of other people doing human rights stuff. And then in 2013, I was invited by an organization called Tactical Tech to a camp with activists, and it was about 100 people. And these were all like really incredible, like brave people that I got to meet. And that's kind of when they were asking a lot about what I was doing and the stuff I was finding, that they were interested in that, was something that kind of was a real big drive and really inspirational for me, because it then went from being, you know, just my hobby to something that I realized could have an impact beyond just what I was doing.
Questions, please stand up and the microphone will come to you.
Hi, and my name is Isabel. We hear a lot about cases in which Bellingcat was right and proved something far before the official research teams came to that conclusions. But is there a case in which Bellingcat was proven wrong?
It's not so much proven wrong. It's more that the thing is, there's loads of stuff we don't publish because we don't get a complete enough answer. So generally anything that we would think we could be proven wrong, then we'll avoid publishing. And it's more that the stuff we can't get across the finishing line, there's plenty of that stuff at the moment. It's like we're looking at the moment at the violence that was happening in Amsterdam last week with the football supporters. Now, we still don't know what happened there. We've certainly gathered all the evidence, all the videos, but whether or not that crosses the threshold into being something we'll ever be able to publish and say this is what happened, is still up in the air a bit.
But so you are looking into the clashes between Maccabi and Moroccan youngsters. What triggered your interest to look at what happened in the night from Thursday to Friday, which is a huge international story now, because at the time, people were saying, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, it's Jews being chased in the canal district of Amsterdam.
It was really the fact that we could see those, you know, videos being shared online that weren't really being analyzed or put into any context. They were being used as just sticks in online arguments. It's like, oh, this video shows, you know, people shouting this thing, oh, the other side shouting something that's just as worse or even, you know, more terrible. And they're just people looking for justifications of the violence of their side in this.
Right,
thing.
But these people who said that, they are politicians, ministers, prime ministers, also, pogroms, they were using the word pogrom.
Yeah, there are people who use very specific language, and it's also interesting to, you know, we're putting things into a timeline of events, but that's not just the videos that show things unfolding, it's when people were saying certain things. Like, very, very quickly, people were specifically blaming Moroccans, which, and these, a lot of these people were also people who had an agenda to that supported. And that entered, I think, some of the mainstream discourse about the events, when there was a lot more going on over that period than it can be kind of simply boiled down to, oh, it was this side or that side. It's not goodies versus baddies.
But are you saying, so the right-wing leader in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders of the PVV, he was one of the first who said, this is scum from Morocco, and we should kick them out of the country. We had enough of these people. Let's get rid of them.
Yeah, because there's no reasonable way for him at that point in time to have known. And he wasn't going around checking the passports of all the people responsible for the violence. There certainly wasn't enough information available in the public to start identifying who these people were. So whatever he would have heard would have been not first-hand information about the incident. And it just happened to fit exactly the way he sees the world, which is always something that's suspicious.
Have you seen the video of the kid of 16 years old who was taping in the city center of Amsterdam, traveled with the fans of Israel, Maccabi, by subway to the city center? Yeah. Started filming, had no idea what was happening, and then suddenly is filming fans of Maccabi making a mess in the city as well, which was totally underreported in the Netherlands, this story.
Mm. Yeah, and again, that's why, you know, like I say, anyone can go out and start doing this work. I mean, just don't wait for someone to give you permission. In fact, if a literal child can go out and film this kind of stuff and actually produce something that I think actually added a lot of understanding, or at least, you know, challenged the mainstream narrative that had emerged around this incident, mm-hmm. more so than any other journalism that was done around these incidents, especially that in that period of time.
There were more questions over here. Please stand up and the microphone comes.
Thank you. I was wondering, because obviously now Bellingcat is a very big community. It's an institute, but you started as an individual. Still, you face individual threat to your person in some ways, and that's very despicable. I was wondering if there's sometimes moments that you wish you had maybe remained under your pseudonym or remained faceless instead of becoming this public face of investigative research that puts you as an individual at risk.
I think that I'm actually very, very fortunate to be able to do this work. There are some negative consequences of that, and I have kind of got used to those. But for me, it's always the fault that, you know, the people who don't like Bellingcat, who are trying to stop us what we're doing, are doing that because we're revealing their wrongdoing, and that some of them are doing, like, really terrible stuff, and that our work has had a positive real-world impact. So I've always kind of... I'm much happier doing this than I was doing anything I was doing before. So, yeah, I'm okay with it.
It's a good question, though. I mean, people in your country, in the UK and everywhere else, have been poisoned by the government of Vladimir Putin. We all know about Alexei Navalny. Have you ever thought or considered, or do you take measures against people who have those ideas and plans?
Yeah, it's along with the kind of psychological support, which part of that is, you know, overlapping with that, because you do that just create a sense of fear that can be quite difficult for some people. It's also just, you know, we have a lot of security consultancy work with our team. We have people come in, like, we will have our staff retreats and we'll have someone come in and spend the morning going on, you know, how to avoid surveillance, detecting surveillance, you know, those kind of things. We have a security officer who is always making sure that we've got the correct security measurements being taken, which I can't go into details of, obviously.
No, but, for example, I was just thinking when there is a glass of water in front of me, I'll drink it not thinking about anything. Are you in a different position?
Yeah, I am in a different position. You've probably noticed I haven't drunk that water.
You haven't touched it yet?
Yeah, just... like, if I go to a hotel, I won't have room service there. There has been suspicions that I've had my room accessed by bad faith actors before. So I also have various mitigations in my room against that at the moment, which I won't go into. But the I take a lot of precautions with this stuff. Doing events, before COVID, there were a couple of people who got a bit stalky with me as well. So fortunately, they're stuck outside of Europe at the moment. But
yes.
Yeah, because you get the state actors, but you also get the crazy people off the internet who are obsessed with you, and those tend to be even more annoying than... I mean, at least with spies, you know, they're just going to poison you. With these guys, they'll just follow you around for ages and ages.
Right, right.
Questions at you.
MH17, we should talk about that, because it's a huge story in the world, especially also in the Netherlands, because the flight left from Amsterdam. You were investigating what happened there, and you were one of the first who came up with answers to what seemed to be a crash and then turned out to be the downing of an airliner.
This happened in Ukraine near the Russian border.
Right to the chaos of the crash.
Tegen het middaguur is vertrokken uit Amsterdam.
When and why did you start your investigation, looking into what had happened here?
So with MH17, really in the immediate aftermath of what happened, a online community started, or multiple communities really, started to form around the incident. And this was just a few days after I launched Bellingcat. It was still being crowdfunded. It was just me by myself. But I started seeing stuff coming out from the online spaces that were discussing MH17 that clearly could benefit from kind of open source investigation techniques I'd already been using in Syria for the last couple of years. So I started looking at some of the stuff that people were digging into, geolocating videos, but also sharing stuff with like my audience that I already had established on social media that were really engaged with this kind of stuff as a general topic, and that included journalists who were on the ground. So we had this online community kind of picking apart all the various online evidence, but then journalists on the ground were seeing the work I was publishing at Bellingcat and going out and actually following that stuff up. So that in itself, in those early days, was assisting journalists in, you know, figuring out what was happening, and led them to finding people who had witnessed the missile launcher being transported. Two journalists visited the launch site that was identified through open source investigation and spoke to, you know, people who saw, you know, the field on fire on the day the missile was launched, and soldiers in the area and that kind of thing.
Was it easy to find all this information?
I don't really think of it in terms of easy and hard, because it's kind of just what we did. But it was really like when you're kind of in that moment, you are surrounded by people who, in a sense, you know, they're finding information, they're sharing it, and you're seeing that, you're seeing the discussions and the debate around it. And it just seems like this organic growth towards certain conclusions, because this information is just, you know, coming to you, you're analyzing it, you're seeing also false information being shared, and that provides various clues. But we were, I was looking at every bolt and rivet of the front end of that aircraft, like really, really careful.
Were you ever asked by the researcher of the joint investigation team here in the Netherlands to share your information with them? Because it took them a year longer to come to the same conclusions as you did with Bellingcat, that Russian separatists had fired this rocket to the MH17.
Yeah, I was, myself and a couple of my colleagues were interviewed as witnesses in the case. And that in November 2014, the police came to the UK and interviewed me as a witness, and I went through every single thing we had written line by line, describing like every single step we took. And I realized months, years later, that I was actually giving them a free training session, and that's what was going on there more than anything.
Really?
Yeah, it's because they went away, and then after that, they set up their own team to do open source investigation within the joint investigation.
Ah, so they copied Bellingcat to get their research going.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very new way of investigating. I mean, the police obviously have done various types of digital investigation before, and I found over the years that when, like, the police have had a lot of interest in this, but they usually pull their staff from more traditional investigative teams, like more like cybercrime and cyber fraud, rather than people who have specific open source investigation skills. And that's something that you're also seeing more and more among law enforcement, that they're picking up on those skills and trying to use them.
Yeah, your conclusion led to Russian separatists. The GIT here in the Netherlands came to the same sort of conclusion and also said we couldn't investigate the role of President Putin, but there is maybe reason to think that the order came from the Kremlin. What would you say?
I mean, certainly, you know, there was a lot of military equipment sent from Russia into Ukraine in 2014. The missile launcher that shot down MH17 was not really unique in any way. It was just part of the war that was being fought. What it was possible to establish from our work in the joint investigation team investigation is that the Russian separatists at that time, who were supported directly by the Russian Federation, were struggling with Ukrainian air attacks. So they requested missile launchers were sent over, and they made these missile launchers available to the separatists. There were actually going to be two of them that were sent over, but they forgot to bring the truck for the second one. So in a way, the only thing that was unusual about this whole story was that MH17 got shot down. But the fact Russia was sending military equipment over of all types is not something that was unique to that day or anything else. It was an ongoing involvement of Russia in the conflict. And I think that's where MH17 really caused a problem for them, because they had a kind of plausible deniability up until that point, but then there was very clear evidence that this was Russia's involvement in the conflict when they'd been denying it all along.
There is a Dutch cameraman who lost somebody on board of the plane who was very dear and close to him, and he went back with journalists to report on the crash site what had happened there, and he has a very moving story. Here is Joris Hentenaar.
About 10 years ago, I had an assignment in Ukraine to film the crash site of the MH17. to make a report about what happened there. And the crash site is totally black. It's like melted aluminium, rubber, burning rubber. It smells like black. Yeah, I went there to the Ukraine, knowing that my babysit child was in the plane and killed. And that makes a strange feeling while you're doing your job. You have to film because that's why you're there. But I also thought, okay, I knew the mama of Rein, so I thought, what could I bring back for his mama? Because all the relatives were not able to visit the site because of the war situation. So I thought, okay, let me just cut the flowers in the surrounding area of the crash site. So I cut the flowers near the crash site, but then I thought, okay, what can we do with them? Because before they die, we have to do something with them. And I knew a Dutch artist, Bas Meus, who makes floral impressions like the Dutch masters in the 17th and 18th century did. So he took photos of all the flowers individual, and then in Photoshop he makes a bouquet of them. The similarity between Bellingcat and we as cameramen is in a way the same. Bellingcat creates, collects data. I collected flowers, and both parties put them together to create something new, the truth or beauty. And in a way, it's a closure because people need to know the truth, and they also need to have beauty.
Joris Hentenaar, he compares your work to a beautiful photograph. You have been called in the Russian press, Russia Today, called you an amateur general, a home garden and kitchen expert, and former video gamer when you published your results on MH17. Are they afraid of you in Moscow?
I always find it interesting looking at how Russia reacts to us. So really from 2015 onwards, so it's been a kind of escalating campaign by Russia against Bellingcat. It started with articles similar to what you've read there. It involved them sending like a camera crew to my doorstepping my mother, which I wasn't very impressed with. They've written all kinds of articles about me. We've been targeted by the Internet Research Agency for disinformation campaigns. I was sued by the founder and head of Wagner, the mercenary company, for saying that he was the head of Wagner, the mercenary company.
Prigozhin, who was blown away by Putin himself.
Yeah, which was an end of my legal case as well. So
seriously?
Yeah.
That's how it ended?
It's... So he sued me in the UK for tweets that linked to articles by other news organisations that mentioned he was involved with Wagner. So he used the SLAPP laws in the UK, or basically a SLAPP against me, to take me to court. It cost, fortunately, Bellingcat covered my legal costs, but just to get it to the point where we were going to ask for money to be held in escrow so he would eventually pay the bills, just getting to that point cost us about £90,000 in legal fees, and that's even before any legal stuff started. Yeah. So what happened in the end is Putin invaded Ukraine, and his lawyers pulled out of the case because of who he was. And the case collapsed, but it left me and Bellingcat out of pocket. But yeah, that's just another example of kind of what happens. And I've been trying to recover the money from him, and then he goes and blows up and makes it very difficult indeed.
That's quite an ending to be...
Yeah, well, I mean, that just shows people why they shouldn't sue me.
Any questions here? Please stand up and the microphone will come to you. Yeah, here you go.
Hi, my name is Brunette. One of my school friends was on the MH17 plane as well, and I was wondering, to what extent do you feel a connection to the victims of the cases that you investigate?
I try to really avoid that kind of connection in most cases, because when you're dealing with like quite a horrific imagery, it's important to have that kind of detachment from the people. But with MH17, over the years, I have got to know the family members. We've been working on the documentary about MH17 that involves the families as well, and they've been very positive about what we've done so far. I think MH17 is a rare example. That plus the victims of chemical weapons in Syria, which is another topic I did a huge amount of work on. It's just, it's been good to talk to those communities. And there are still ongoing kind of accountability efforts with both of those topics as well. So we've been able to support them through that as well.
So, but these are two stories where you met the family members of the victims, but normally you try to distance yourself from the emotions of family members because that could interfere with the research that you are doing?
Well, one thing that's really important in this kind of work is understanding the impact of vicarious trauma. So that's trauma that, you know, could be PTSD, it's very other types of trauma, where by looking at lots of horrifying images, it can have a deep impact on you.
That's what you are doing, right?
A big part of that not having an impact is compartmentalization of, you know, you're looking at an image, you're doing a piece of research, you aren't thinking about, you know, these people being human beings with families, because if you do that all the time, then it quickly becomes overwhelming. And like at Bellingcat, we offer our staff kind of psychological support. We are very open about these issues. There's been other human rights organizations who have tried to ignore these issues, and that's led to lots of problems for those organizations. So it's something that you need to deal with head on.
Do you get help yourself or assistance with everything that you have seen and heard?
I think I was quite lucky. I used to have quite a lot of anxiety, and by doing this work, it's actually helped really build my confidence a lot. So I think that's maybe acted to balance out all the terrible traumatic, you know, stuff that I'm seeing. But a lot of it is, I think, just through being quite practiced at doing it as well.
Yeah.
Because you, like I spoke about with the early videos, I would, you know, not listen to what people were saying, but also generally you want to turn the audio of videos off if you're looking at something that involves someone like injured or in pain, or people who are scared, because it's the kind of audio, it's that kind of subconscious kind of your reaction to that sound that actually can trigger the trauma response. So often when you're watching these videos, you'll not watch them with any volume on either, just so you're not having that extra trigger kind of in your headspace.
Right. We have good people here in this crowd, nothing happening. So, Joris Antonar, the cameraman that you just saw and who has worked in the Ukraine, he wanted to be here tonight, but he was filming somewhere, and he's in awe with your work, and he asked us to give you something from him that we have here, and we hope you will unpack it. I'm absolutely sure that this came directly from Joris. This is a little gift from him to you.
Would you like me to open it here?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not ticking, so that's good. There we go. Do you see that? That's the print that he was talking about.
Right, the sunflowers from the crash site of the MH17.
That's right.
Yeah. We were talking about Alexei Navalny and you taking your precautions. Bellingcat was working on this film that was nominated and got the Oscar about Navalny. And in the film, we see him, for those of you who haven't seen it, you found out basically who were the FSB agents who set this all up, and you found out who they were, telephone numbers, everything. And in the film, the most astonishing moment is, I think, that Navalny is calling with the people who tried to murder him. We have a little clip here of that film, Navalny.
Возможно, там, возможно, и там что-то было. Мне как бы тоже там замывали. Ну, обрабатывали.
So here we go. This is the moment that they themselves, the FSB agent, basically says, okay, I did it, and this is how I did it. What did you think when you saw this?
So I knew Christo and Navalny and the filmmaker we were working with were going to sit down and film stuff. And
Christo was at the time the CEO of Bellingcat, right?
Yeah, and we just thought he'd probably phone up four or five people, they'd all hang up with him, and that would be it. And it'd be just like a little clip they could use in one of the FBK YouTube videos. So they called the first few guys up, which is, you know, they sussed it and got it straight away. But Navalny said he wanted to try something different. And what they had got is a phone number spoofer. And they could basically spoof the number of the main FSB headquarters when they phoned up the next guy. So his caller ID would say it was coming from the FSB headquarters. And then Navalny just went into... And this call was about 50 minutes long, so you see a very short version of it in the film. We published the whole thing online. But, yeah, he then just improvises just this whole interrogation for this guy. And, you know, he was keeping his calm. If you watch the whole... I mean, the whole thing was 50 minutes long, and this guy was just giving him really intimate details of every single part of the assassination. We knew a lot of the kind of names and where they were at certain times, but we didn't know why. So we could compare what he was saying to information that we already had, and it all fit perfectly with everything we knew. So, yeah, and the guy just confessed to every single little detail of the assassination and just, yeah, it really proved exactly what had happened.
And what was the impact of this story? What, I mean, okay, you won the Oscar, but what was the judicial impact?
I mean, the thing is absolutely nothing because this is something that happened inside Russia. It was, you know, basically it's not up to anyone else to investigate it but Russia, and obviously Russia has no interest in doing that. Part of the reason we were looking into these assassinations, that, I mean, there were multiple assassinations, both inside Russia and outside of Russia by different teams. The reason we wanted to look into them is because no one else was going to look into them in the country itself, because the local media certainly wasn't going to be in a position to do that. And the authorities responsible for investigating it, in actually some cases, were the same team doing the poisonings.
Yeah.
So there was no real accountability possible whatsoever.
In the film, Christo also states that how easy it was to find this information, telephone numbers, names, because people in Russia were willing to sell it for money. Now, this is an interesting topic for journalists, I think. What is your idea on buying information to further your investigation?
This was, I mean, in this case, it was something very unusual. It's not what we normally do. When we first did it, it was almost done as almost like a half a joke, because Christo had been... Basically, Christo's hobby was buying this data for his various projects. In Russia, you basically have a police state that's incredibly corrupt, so the police state will sell people the information that it's gathering on its citizens, and usually for a very small amount of money. So this would include government databases of like where people lived, and that stuff was available for sale. I read an article in the Financial Times from 12 years ago where they're talking about there being like a market in a town in Russia where people are just selling government databases burnt onto DVDs for people to buy. You can also buy people's detailed phone records, so we're able to do that for the suspects in various poisoning cases. But it really started with the Skripal poisoning, and there the two identities of the suspects were made public. And a Russian newspaper was able to get a passenger list for the flight they came into the UK with. And there it showed their passport numbers, which were only three or four digits different, which, considering there were supposedly two individuals who were, you know, private individuals, there should be no reason for that to be the case. So we just kind of came up with the idea that maybe these guys are spies. So you can buy the registration form they use to register for their passports, and there's a copy of that on some government database that you can just go and buy for 10 euros. So Christo went and brought that almost as a joke, but when it came back, it was like literally had the phone number of the Russian Ministry of Defense stamped on it saying, call this number if you see this document. And it had an abbreviation for Secret Service stamped on it as well. So it's pretty obvious that these guys were not the sports nutrition salesmen they were claiming to be on Russia Today. So we were watching these two guys being interviewed by the head of Russia Today, claiming that they were sports nutrition salesmen who had come to Salisbury Cathedral to see the famous, and they were very specific, 123-meter spire, which is the first line of the Wikipedia entry.
Yeah.
And we would literally have the document in our hands saying that, no, they were actually working for the intelligence services.
that easy it can be. For 10 euro, you can buy evidence.
Yeah, it's harder now because...
now they know.
The government's cracked down on that sort of thing. Yeah. Since, we did stuff with it.
Any questions? There are more, I know. Please stand up.
I was just wondering what made you investigate Skripal's assassination poisoning attempt?
At the time, there wasn't that much information released about what happened, and we couldn't really do anything about it. Then, because there was the information that was published by the UK in terms of their identities, and then that still wasn't enough for us to do anything with that, but when those passport numbers were leaked in that flight manifest, that's what got us interested in the Skripal poisoning, because then we had something we could work with. And really, from that point onwards, it was just unpicking who these people were. In one case, we could do that through the documents that were available through these various sources. In another one, we basically created a profile of the person we were looking for. We thought, well, he's operating abroad, so he looks about this age range. What military school would he have come from? And there's only one that made any sense. So then we went to that military school's website where they had things like... they had a wall of heroes, and people had been taking photographs of it, and he had his face on there because he was giving the Hero of Russia medal, and that had his real name underneath the picture of him that was very clear.
Wow.
So it was just everything we unpicked, it opened up, 10 new things to look at.
Do you like puzzles?
Only if they're in computer game format. I really hate doing Rubik's Cubes. I think they're stupid and annoying, and I don't know why anyone would want to do it. But yeah, I like a puzzle that has a point to it.
And that's what you do. So you are puzzling, and it has a point to it because it leads to a well-researched story. You were talking about Twitter and how it was in the beginning a great tool to get information from. Now, Twitter is X. The owner has changed. It's Elon Musk, and he is very powerful now in the U.S., will have a position within the next government of President Trump.
You can tell by the changes he's made to X that he has no idea what he's doing, because everything he's done to it, first, the verified tick marks, which, A, completely devalued one of the most important things that people, saw in Twitter was you had verified people. Plus, it also gave people a higher ranking in the algorithm, so for grifters, that was... perfect. Also because the kind of for you recommendations are being forced onto you automatically, it's meant there's more reason for people to game those algorithms. He also restored a bunch of accounts that were banned for spreading false information, and those have been very, very active spreading false information about what's happening in Gaza at the moment.
Yeah, but you also said he's full of shit.
Yes, he is.
Yes. Because?
I mean, one example of this is where he claimed that Bellingcat was a psyop, a psychological operation, and then he was asked by a journalist why, and all he could say is that, oh, Bellingcat's a psyop. He doesn't have anything behind that. He just gets told something. Yeah. He's no different from just a million other people who use the internet and just get sucked into conspiracy theories and,
Is he dangerous?
Well, I mean, with the amount of money he's got, and it'd be... I mean, I wonder how dangerous he's going to be in the Trump administration, because my feeling is what's probably going to happen is he'll do some stupid drastic cut. It'll cause some huge problem. Donald Trump will then have to fire him, and then he's going to have a meltdown online about how unfair life is. But I just don't... It seems more... I'm hoping more for chaos than any real justice or intelligence coming from the Trump administration, because at least that'll hopefully mitigate some of the worst stuff they could be doing if they knew what they were up to.
Questions?
Hi, my name is Amy. Social media is one of the biggest resources for your work. I was wondering, how do you feel about the younger generation, including your own kids, growing up in a world full of social media and also being exposed to this harmful and violent content that you guys analyze?
I think they are growing up in a very tough information environment that it presents a lot of risks to them. I think one thing that I think is becoming a worse and worse trend is basically just people mimicking other successful and truthful people. We've seen it, for example, with the open source investigation community, where you now have loads of these Austin accounts that are just stealing content from elsewhere. You see it on a whole range of things, where something becomes popular, and then there's 100 shit versions of it that's created to farm the algorithm. And like, I see my daughter using social media. She's 13, she's had a phone for less than a year, so she's completely addicted to everything by this point. But it just seems like everything is just like a copy of something else now. That as soon as there's an original idea, there'll be so many people trying to copy it and get on top of that. It's just creating this completely, again, it's the shitification of the internet. It's just that information environment is just really poor for gathering information about how the world, you know, what the news is.
Is it fair to say that as a dad, I'm a dad as well, there comes a point in time, maybe now you can control your daughter's media consumption, but that won't take a lot of years anymore before she is on her own and she's looking at everything that she wants to. You can't protect her forever.
It's more about trying to teach her, you know, I've got a lot of experience in...
Yes.
But she's not going to listen to me because I'm her dad talking to her about the internet.
I talk from experience. My daughter's a little bit older than yours.
But I think I'm lucky that I at least work in an area where it's part of the mood, you know, the background music talking about these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that really worries me at the moment is deepfake pornography, especially targeting young girls, because this is something that's happening in schools already.
Wait a second, deepfake pornography? What?
Yeah, so the ability to take a photograph of an individual and turn that into pornography has gone from something that 18 months ago was very difficult and needed expertise to now you can get multiple apps that do that for you for free. And this is something that is being used by teenage boys in school to target girls. And these are underage girls as well. So this causes all kinds of different issues.
Wow, it's so depressing. Involved.
But that's kind of like, that is what really worries me in terms of kind of girls and kind of online content.
Because you know what's going to happen if it is your daughter when she's online in these positions or in a film like this, because everybody will think it's real.
This is the issue, and there have been multiple cases now where young girls have killed themselves over these situations. So I don't really think schools have any idea what's coming until it's going to be too late for them. And I think there needs to be a lot more education in this area because it does present a really huge amount of risk, I think.
Okay, before we let you go, Christian Triebert had some sort of really funky question to you from the New York Times.
Elliot,
it's a mysterious question. This is the one.
Grateful for everything you you have meant for me and others. I've been asked to ask you a question, and I'm very happy about this because I'm wondering, after 48K dreams and after 512K dreams, what's going to be the next dream for you?
Before you answer the question, you first have to explain what this is all about, I think.
So I am a huge nerd, I think it's fair to say. So I've got... have any of you encountered kind of AI-generated music over the last 6 months and how much improvement it's made? So there's various platforms. There's one called Suno and one called Udio that lets you make AI-generated music. And I spend way, way too much time doing that. So I have made a couple of albums that are available online if you're so inclined. I'm not saying you should, and I would prefer you didn't. But I made one called 48K Dreams, which is a series of songs about the 48K spectrum. Do you know, and you know that ZX48K? You're way, way too young for that. It's...
Christian told me, but you have to tell it.
It's a... early computer from 1981, which had rubber keyboards and was a big part of my childhood nostalgia, as is 512K Dreams, which is about the Amiga 500, which is another...
Elliot, you are a proper nerd, you are.
Yeah. But I also always do it with the most sincerity as well, because I find that funny if it's, like, really sincere.
Yeah. Did we get an answer now?
After that, oh God, it would have to be, like, because it's a sequence, it would have to be about the next computer I had, which was the IBM PC, so.
That's the answer?
Yeah, that would
yeah,
be
sure.
About that.
I could have given that. Okay, before we let you go, what is the best advice you have for the students here and the people who are watching this at home or wherever they are?
Don't wait for permission to get started on stuff that you care about, find interesting. You also have a huge community that's ready to support you and get involved. So, yeah, seek them out, and I wish you luck.
Elliot Higgins.